Yet one more danger of aflatoxin exposure.
The function of HDL cholesterol and how it affects heart disease.
Too much thyroid hormone and fracture.
And oral contraceptives and the risk of venous clots.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 29th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science System in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should start with this issue of the newer oral contraceptives and the risk of venous thromboembolism or blood clots. That's in the British Medical Journal, an emerging issue that's been gaining traction.
About 9% of women in reproductive age worldwide use oral contraceptives. That percentage rises to about 18% of women in developed countries and about a fourth of women in the United Kingdom. We've known that the use of oral contraceptives increases the risk of clotting, or what's called thrombosis, particularly in the veins, for example, the veins in the legs. Or you can also get clots in the lung, pulmonary emboli. The real question is, as we've developed these newer oral contraceptives, what's the risk of having clots form in these agents as opposed to the older agents? These investigators looked at two large databases in the United Kingdom, and they were able to identify over 10,000 cases of women that had had venous thromboembolism. They examined their use of oral contraceptives, the older types and the newer types. And what they discovered was that with the older types, it increased the risk of developing venous thromboembolism or clots by about 2.5-fold over women that were not taking oral contraceptives. But the newer ones, it increased the risk about 3.5 to 4.5-fold.
Clearly something that's very concerning. Aren't there other risk factors that are associated with this propensity to develop clots?
There are indeed. For example, people that lead a sedentary lifestyle, or people that have other chronic diseases, or people that have a genetic propensity. But even when you take all of that out of the picture, and they did that in this particular study, there still was a significantly increased association of thromboembolism disease with the newer agents as opposed to the older agents. In fact, it was even more robust. Let's put it in absolute terms. With the older agents, the risk or the number of women that would have this would be about 6 or 7 per 10,000 women treated. That goes up to about 14 per 10,000 women treated with the newer agents.
Okay, so the absolute risk isn't that high, but let's talk about for the individual. For somebody who is considering the use of these agents, which also admittedly have a number of benefits in comparison to the older ones, how should they approach this decision?
I think it's helpful, first of all, to have the information, to discuss it with your physician. Secondly, unless there's some overwhelming case to be on the newer agents, it seems to me that it's safer to be on the older agents, at least with respect to venous thromboembolism.
Well, I guess it's something that we really need to keep our eye on and just call out to women who are taking oral contraceptives to be aware. From here, why don't we turn to this issue I served up as yet one more danger of aflatoxin exposure. Aflatoxin, of course, this byproduct of a fungus, and that's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And the particular fungus is called Aspergillus, and it's ubiquitous in nature. It is known to affect various grains that have been sitting around and become moist, and the aflatoxin name comes from Aspergillus flavus toxins. It's a fungal toxin that we know is associated with liver cancer. So here's the interesting story. In Chile, gallbladder cancer is the leading cause of cancer death in women. Interestingly enough, red chili peppers is associated with gallbladder cancer. Red chili peppers in women in Chile is associated with gallbladder cancer. Well, in fact, it may not be the chilies themselves, but these particular food products can be contaminated with aflatoxin. And so what these authors did was they examined consecutive cases of women that presented with gallbladder cancer. They looked in comparison to women that had gallbladder disease, that is gallstones, and then in women that had neither of the above. And they measured aflatoxin. And what they determined was that there was a clear association both in the presence of aflatoxin and the level of aflatoxin in women with gallbladder cancer versus those that just had gallbladder disease or those that had no gallbladder issues at all.
Well, what can we do about this? It's an interesting association, but now what?
I'm glad you brought that out. We know aflatoxin is one of the more toxic chemicals identified, particularly for causing cancer. This tells me that before we put red chili peppers out on the market, those should be tested for aflatoxin, and any evidence of that should mean that those should be taken off the market altogether.
Is this an unusual foodstuff to be associated with aflatoxin contamination?
we usually associate with grains and sorghum. So this is the first time that I heard it could be associated with red chili peppers.
Well, I just wonder if this means that other foods that are dried ought to be assessed for the same thing.
That's a great question. Two of the authors are there in Maryland, Baltimore. Perhaps we ought to address this with them and ask them.
Okay, that's a good idea. I can go across the street and do that. From here, let's go to the idea that somehow too much thyroid hormone could be associated with fractures. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association also.
We know that people that have an overtly overactive thyroid or hyperthyroid, that is an established risk factor for osteoporosis, thinning of the bones, and also for fractures. And the real question is, what about people that have subclinical hyperthyroidism? Their blood tests are slightly abnormal, but the people have no symptoms at all. Are they at risk? And if so, does treatment for hyperthyroidism help lower that risk? These investigators looked at available studies, all prospective studies, that looked at the association of overt hyperthyroidism with bone disease. Over 70,000 participants. And among those, about 3% had subclinical hyperthyroidism, abnormal blood tests, but actually no manifestations clinically. These individuals were followed for about 750,000 person years. What they discovered was this condition increased the risk of various fractures. It increased the risk by about 50 to 70%. Now, some of these people with subclinical hyperthyroidism, it was due to the fact they were taking too much medications, but some it was endogenous, that it was a native disease. And in both circumstances, the presence of subclinical hyperthyroidism was associated with bone disease and fractures.
So this sounds like then a factor that needs to be looked at with regard to screening.
Absolutely. The authors make the point that if you have overt hyperthyroidism, only about 5% subsequently go on to develop symptoms. So it ends up being a subclinical disease for a long period of time. It's just a lab abnormality. So this ought to be a routine part of the screening panel, in my opinion, when people have routine examinations. Now, the next question is, if you treat this, will it in fact lower the fracture risk? And this study didn't address that. And the next step, we actually need to prove that in additional studies.
Okay, so instead of panning a screening test, we're advocating for a screening test. That's something rather unusual. Finally, let's take a look at HDL cholesterol efflux and heart disease. That's in the Lancet Diabetes Endocrinology.
For decades, we've known that there's an association between the level of HDL cholesterol and the incidence of heart disease. It's an inverse relationship. The higher the HDL cholesterol, the lower the risk of heart disease. On the basis of that, over the last several years, we've tried different medications to raise the HDL cholesterol level. And we've had a number of medications that can do that. None of them has been successful in lowering the risk of heart disease. In fact, some of them have increased the risk of death because of what's called off-target effects. So we had to take a step back and say, wait a minute, we can raise HDL cholesterol pharmacologically, but we can't lower the risk of heart disease. Maybe we need to look at not just the level of HDL, but the function of HDL. And one of the things that HDL cholesterol does, besides the fact it's an anti-inflammatory and it decreases the risk of forming clots, it actually causes cholesterol to be moved from some of the cells inside the lining of the artery out of the lining of the artery where they can be excreted. That's called HDL efflux. So what these authors did is said, well, gosh, we have the ability to take blood samples in people we have followed for 30 or 40 years. When we first saw them, they had no heart disease. And over the course of the next 30 or 40 years, they developed it, but they had a baseline blood sample. And for those that develop heart disease, they compared to those that did not with regard to how well did their HDL cholesterol pull cholesterol out of the bloodstream, this HDL efflux. So looking at over 3,500 patients, half of whom had heart disease, half of whom did not, they were able to establish a clear relationship, not between HDL level, but between the ability of HDL cholesterol to cause efflux, that is the movement of cholesterol. The better that HDL was able to do that, the lower the risk of heart disease.
Okay, so an interesting aha moment. What is its practical import?
Well, two things. One is this association is independent of other risk factors. It's independent, for example, of sex and age and diabetes and high blood pressure, smoking, alcohol use, the type of adiposity or fat. So it appears like it is a robust association. What that tells us is that what we need to do is to be able to identify, based upon that, whether HDL is protective or not, and perhaps our next pharmacologic or drug treatment should be directed not towards raising HDL levels, but either raising the type that causes efflux or somehow augmenting that particular function.
Okay, interesting association. Seems like it's going to be a long time before it comes to fruition. I could be wrong. On that note then, I'll reveal that I'm going to talk about the oral contraceptives this week in the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.